And now, it is time for the Earth First update. All the environmental news you can use for this week. Let's start off with an announcement. The California Native Plant Society Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team this Saturday will be having one of their Saturday restorations. That's right, Saturday, February 7th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. We had a tremendous early year start in tackling restoration efforts at the ranch with Chuck Bauman in the lead. Close to 75 volunteers showed up at the park for our last project, an additional volunteer day of community service on Martin Luther King Day. There is lots more work at Quail Hollow Ranch. We will continue our restoration efforts on maintaining our broom sites, that is French broom. They're taking it out of there. And maybe take on new work sites at the ranch. Chuck will be in the lead again this Saturday, starting in March or early April. Linda will start to mix our other project sites for variety. Bash a few brooms for me. I'll see you all on February 21st. That's in a couple of weeks for her. Directions to Quail Hollow Ranch. Take Graham Hill Road up from Santa Cruz as you come down into Felton. Turn right at the light on East Ziani Road. Go up about 2 miles. Turn left on Quail Hollow Road. Another half mile up. The park entrance is on the right side. Meet in the gravel parking lot. Yeah, right around 10 a.m. there. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands in Santa Cruz County. The program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore these special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. And there might actually be some shine this Saturday, who knows. But if it gets particularly unpleasant, they call it a day. And this rain might help loosen up some of that broom. Tools are provided, but bring water and gloves. For more information, contact Linda. Her number 462-4041. Or give her an email at redwoodrn. That's REDWDRN at pacbell.net. Or visit their website at www.cruisecnps.org. Once again, Linda's number 462-4041. There's also another habitat restoration going on that same day. Starts a little earlier, runs a little later. This one's taking place at the Seacliff State Beach. They're going to be on the upper bluff doing some planting in coordination with state parks. Once again, this Saturday, February 7th, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., the Seacliff Improvement Association is undertaking to restore the upper bluff area from 95% invasive weeds and plants to eventually 80% California native plants and grasses. This task will take a number of years and will be accomplished by hand planting islands of native plants and grasses and managing the invasive weeds that crop up in those areas. This method of restoration gives nature a helping hand as the islands of native plants and grasses manufacture their own native seeds and self-seed with the assistance of the wind and the birds, and thus naturally increase the ratio of native plants to invasive plants throughout the Upper Bluff area. For more information on this habitat restoration project, contact Terry Lynn Winston. Her number, I guess it's a her. 685-3406. That's 685-3406. Or just show up at the bluff, Seacliff Beach State Park at 9 a.m. this Saturday. All right. Let's get into the news here. British forest defenders protest embassy on behalf of Tasmanian forests. British activists marked Australia Day by climbing trees and hanging banners in front of the Australian High Commission in London to highlight the continued destruction of Tasmania's old-growth and high-conservation value forests. This action has coincided with British MP Norman Baker's decision to table an early motion on Parliament regarding recent roading operations in the Upper Florentine Valley in Tasmania. Forest activists and community members have relaunched Camp Florentine with a number of new tree sits and road-blockading structures set up over the last weekend. The devastation of some of Tasmania's ancient forests is a critical global issue. Once again, the Tasmanian and Australian governments' continued support of Forestry Tasmania and Guns Unlimited environmentally criminal operations is being shown up as an international disgrace, said Still Wild, Still Threatened spokesperson Ulla Majewski. The World Heritage Center, the IUCN, and now members of the British Parliament have expressed their interest and concerns regarding Forestry Tasmania's atrocious roading operations in the Upper Florentine Valley. We once again call on Minister Garrett, who will be visiting Tasmania this week to show some real leadership and put a halt to the destruction of these World Heritage valued forests, said Ms. Majewski. And moving a little south, we go to Uganda, where a forest protection president suspends a government worker for stopping illegal logging. A forestry official who blocked State House staff and UPDF soldiers from stealing timber from forest reserves was unfairly suspended at the urging of President Yoweri Museveni. The Sunday Monitor has learned Mr. George Gasana, a sector manager with the National Forest Authority, was suspended after President Museveni raised a complaint with Minister Maria Mutagamba that the former was selling and leasing government forests. An interministerial committee was later constituted to investigate Mr. Gasana, who was in charge of Luamunda forest sector covering Mpigi and Wasiko districts, and the report, a copy of which Sunday Monitor has seen, cleared him of any wrongdoing. Apparently, documents show that state agents who would ordinarily be the ones to promote forest conservation were instead the ones directly or indirectly degrading the forest through illegal activities like tree cutting, sand mining, brick making, and even construction of houses in the forest reserves. Sources say because of heavy involvement of state agents, officials of National Forest Agency, an agency mandated to protect and conserve forests, have faced difficult times in implementing their mandate, with some unfairly suspended from work while some have been killed on duty. The paper has learned that some security agents and State House staff whom Mr. Gasana had blocked were the ones who could have misinformed the president. Mr. Gasana could have landed himself in trouble with state agents after he impounded several vehicles belonging to high-profile individuals. These vehicles were found to be carrying illegal timber and sand. Presidential Press Secretary Joseph Tamale Murundi said State House has no powers to authorize transportation of illegal timber. Mr. Tamale said one Joseph Mugimba, was interdicted at State House but continues to transact business as a State House employee. We have had so many cases about Mugimba. He went away with our documents and headed papers, he said. And the Center for Biological Diversity is fighting a Bush-era interference harming 19 species in 9 states. And this leftover news from last year, filing a final challenge to the Bush administration over its political meddling in almost 60 Endangered Species Act decisions, the Center for Biological Diversity filed 7 lawsuits over habitat protection decisions involving 18 species, as well as one notice of intent to sue over the denial of protection for Colorado River cutthroat trout. The San Bernardino kangaroo rat, Arkansas River shiner, Riverside fairy shrimp, 12 Texas invertebrates, and 3 California plants were all robbed of federal habitat protections on Bush's watch. In the case of the Riverside fairy shrimp, more than 97% of the area of habitat deemed by scientists as essential was removed from protection thanks to interference by Bush administration officials. In all, more than 158,000 protected areas are at stake in the last 7 week suits. The Colorado River cutthroat trout was denied protection despite severe range loss, ongoing threats, and repeated Center for Biological Diversity actions. The Bush administration's mismanagement of the Endangered Species Act, now under extensive federal investigation, is the focus of the center's litigating political corruption campaign, through which we've already had substantial success in fighting to restore proper protections for 59 imperiled species. And feds are revisiting protection for Southern California fish, acknowledging the fishiness of one of its more scientifically flawed and politically tainted Bush Area Endangered Species Act decisions. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service reached a settlement with the Center for Biological Diversity and their allies over a rule slashing habitat protections for one of California's freshwater swimmers, the Santa Ana sucker. The small-bodied, big-lipped fish, although highly adaptable, has suffered serious harm from development water projects and other threats and is now reduced to just 3 populations in the middle part of the Santa Ana River. Interjecting here, the last time I saw the Santa Ana River, it was a concrete ditch, but perhaps there's something that I don't know about. In response to a center lawsuit in 2004, the Fish and Wildlife Service protected more than 21,000 acres of habitat along 3 of the fish's 4 home rivers, only to issue a scientifically unjustifiable decision a year later to reduce the protected area to a measly 8,300 acres, eliminating protections for the sucker's namesake river, the Santa Ana. Our lawsuit for the Santa Ana sucker, filed in November of 2007 with CalTrout, California-Nevada chapter of the American Fisheries Society and Friends of the River, is another part of our litigating political corruption campaign. Hopefully all 59 species we're fighting for will get the attention they truly deserve under the new Obama administration. For more information, go to the webpage for the Center for Biological Diversity at www.biologicaldiversity.org. And there's a crisis situation for Marin's coho salmon in this story by Peter Fimwright of the San Francisco Chronicle. The lack of rain this winter has contributed to what fisheries biologists say is so far the worst return of coho salmon in the recorded history of Marin County's Lagunitas Creek watershed, one of California's most critical ecosystems for the endangered fish. Only a small smattering of coho were spotted, and only 20 egg nests, or reds, were seen in the 2 main tributaries of Lagunitas and San Geronimo Creeks during the annual winter survey of fish, watershed biologists have reported. The paltry showing of reds represents an 89% drop in the number of returning offspring of parents that gave birth in the lush western Marin watershed just 3 years ago. Last year, at this time, 148 reds had been counted, then the lowest number in 14 years that records have been kept, said Paula Bowley, the Conservation Program Director for the Salmon Protection and Watershed Network, or SPAWN. "It's just frightening, actually," Bowley said. "We were expecting 70 reds, which is still a 63% decline. It's definitely a crisis situation." The waterway, which winds its way through the picturesque San Geronimo Valley on the northwest side of Mount Tamalpais, typically supports the largest wild run of salmon left in the state, historically about 10% of California's coho population. During the first winter rains, the spawning fish swim 33 miles from the open ocean in Tamales Bay and up the creek through the redwood-studded valley to lay their eggs and die. The females lay their eggs only after they've found the place where they were born 3 years before. The decline this year is alarming, given that 190 reds were counted in 2005 when the parents of these coho laid their eggs. The plummeting coho numbers exacerbate a near catastrophic decline in the overall population of salmon along the West Coast. So few Chinook salmon returned to spawn in the Sacramento-San Joaquin River system last year that ocean fishing had to be banned in California and Oregon, and probably will be again this year. The number of coho eggs throughout the state declined about 70% last year. The low number of coho in the Lagunitas watershed in 2007 was shocking, given that a record 496 reds were counted in 2004, the year that they were born. "We had our best year class in 2004, Bowley said. "What happened is our best year class turned into our worst year class, and this year is looking even worse." Fisheries biologists believe the primary cause is the unusually dry weather in Northern California, which has prevented salmon from swimming up the creeks. The rains in December were barely enough to breach sandbars on most beaches, forcing salmon up and down the coast to circle in the open ocean where they are vulnerable to sea lions and other predators. "It's not looking good," said Sean Hayes, a National Marine Fisheries Service biologist who monitors salmon in Scott Creek, here in Santa Cruz County, the southernmost coho run in California, just north of the town of Davenport. "The fish have been hammered a couple of years in a row now. If it doesn't rain, there could be a spawning failure this year, which would be catastrophic." Bowley said a big rainstorm could turn things around, but hardly any rain is expected. Though we did have some over the last couple of days. "If things don't improve," she said, "this year's cycle of fish may go extinct." The lack of salmon in the Lagunitas Creek is a major concern, she said, because the watershed is a statewide model for fisheries restoration. The first winter rains normally bring schools of coho wriggling up the creeks, drawing tourists, school children, and naturalists to watch the fish leap from the foaming rapids. The Lagunitas population is critical to the viability of the entire Central California coho population. It is the keystone watershed along the coast, Booley said. Fisheries agencies look to Lagunitas as the key for recovery for neighboring watersheds. We don't have any streams left to seed them if this one is gone. The watershed is unique in that the primary spawning grounds are in the middle of developed communities. Since coho were listed as endangered in 2005 under the Endangered Species Act, many residents have taken a proprietary interest in the fish. Schools have become involved, organizing work parties and teaching children about historic coho migrations. More than a century ago, about 6,000 coho spawned in the system of streams every year. At that time, the salmon swam from Tamales Bay virtually to the top of Mount Tamalpais, spawning in tributaries all along the way. But industry started taking a toll almost from the day Joseph Warren Revere spotted the valley in 1846 and saw a copious stream fed by mountain brooks. The redwood forests surrounding the creek were logged between 1860 and 1900. Subsequently, homes and roads built along the waterway removed about 60% of the original riparian habitat. The first major dam, which created Lake Lagunitas, was built in 1873. Six more dams were constructed over the next century, the largest being Peter's Dam at Kent Lake, finished in 1953 and then raised another 42 feet higher in 1982. The dams blocked about 50% of the historic salmon habitat, reducing the amount of gravel and increasing sedimentation on the creeks, but the decline was slow. Old-timers have told how they used to spearfish from decks or garage hatches overlooking the creek. In 1959, when the habitat was already in serious decline, the largest recorded coho salmon in state history, a 22-pound fish, was taken out of Lagunitas Creek. The restoration efforts began in the early 1980s when a group called Trout Unlimited began lobbying the county to stop the decline of the fishery. Spawn, created in 1996, sponsors salmon-watching creek walks during spawning season and has saved more than 15,000 juvenile salmon and steelhead from drying pools in the summer. The Marin Municipal Water District, which is required by the state to help the coho as mitigation for raising Peter's Dam, started counting coho reds in the early 1990s and now works with spawn to monitor releases from the dam, install woody debris in the creeks, and replant vegetation. This is the beacon of hope for the California watershed, Booley said, but the fish are missing. They're gone. And in a related story, can native fish species be saved? In this story by Amy Coombs. Researchers now postulate that fish can take magnetic imprints of the streams in which they are born and are thus able to find their way homes to spawn. The findings bolster a report published by a local nonprofit. It shows the fish that fed the famous outdoor tourist industry now face extinction and are in need of critical support. San Francisco-based California Trout Incorporated published a comprehensive review of the state's native fish species in late November. After reviewing 32 independent unaffiliated studies, they found that 65% of steelhead salmon and trout will likely become extinct in the next 50 to 100 years, including three species found on the Central Coast. Known for its maroon sides and dark green heads, the Central California coast salmon is nearly extinct today and is rarely spotted in local waters. To help prevent future calamity, the organization recommends more stringent environmental laws and local protection efforts. The report is a message of hope because there is still time left for people to wake up and rally around these fish, said Scott Fierabend, interim executive director of Cal Trout. The problem is that reintroducing fish species may be more difficult than previously imagined. Caltrout's report follows a wave of new studies on fish navigation. While many fish return to their home streams to spawn, hatchery fish often don't fare as well. New findings suggest that this may be due to magnetic imprints that the fish use to navigate through the water. We propose that salmon and sea turtles form imprints of the unique magnetic signature in their area, and this is how they find their way back home, said Kenneth Lohman, biologist for the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We found that some fish and turtles have the biologic... Let me try that again. We found that some fish and turtles have the biologic equivalent of a GPS system that helps them with navigation. While past research has shown that fish can read magnetic signatures like humans read a compass, Lohmann recently demonstrated that a stream's magnetic fields remain consistent over enough time to serve as a reliable source of information for the fish. The findings were published this month in the academic journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And actually, that was probably last month, seeing how it's been in my folder for a little while. While chemical signals help salmon find their way back to specific stretches of river, they don't diffuse into the ocean. This has long raised questions about the way fish find their original rivers and streams after straying miles upshore. If magnetic sensing helps fish swim in the right direction along the coastline and magnetic imprints help fish identify their starting points, this may help explain some of the problems fisheries face when repopulating empty rivers, said Lohmann. Fish introduced into a stream after birth might not ever learn to call it home, and fish born in hatcheries might be confused by the unique magnetic characteristics of the hatchery. He speculates that rebar, the poles of metal that provide cement walls and structures, might interrupt the magnetic field that surrounds growing fish. Pumps and other electrical devices used in hatcheries might also play a role. It's something that hasn't been considered very much, says Lohmann. While more research needs to be done to test the impacts of hatchery electric fields on spawning fish, the growing body of evidence indicates that animals like turtles and fish are responsive to subtle electromagnetic changes. If returning fish search for the magnetic field associated with an upstream hatchery, they might pass the river mouth, at least if it has a different magnetic signature. Historically, even fish of the same species don't often fare well when raised in hatcheries. While local nonprofits are trying their best to reintroduce coho salmon in the San Lorenzo River, the fish sometimes don't return to the same area. Even fish that are caught from the wild and then bred in a hatchery don't take hold. It's hard when the native species go into a threatened status, said Bill Coker, director of the Santa Cruz City Water Department. You try to fool Mother Nature by raising fish, but even when we trap them and hatch the eggs, we don't see the returns that we get with hatchery fish. While Cal Trout's new report doesn't emphasize the problems faced by hatchery fish, there is a general agreement that preventing local fish extinctions is better than repopulating rivers after a species has died off. We will do much better if we can, as Fierabend. Two fish found along the central coast face extinction, says the report. The South Central California coast steelhead, which is found in the Pajaro River and other more southern watersheds, is primarily losing out due to alterations of natural stream flow patterns. Historic runs total more than 27,000 adults, but today there are fewer than 5,000 of the fish in California's waters. During dry season, this drops below 2,000. A fish that shares a similar name, the Central California Coast Steelhead, has also declined by as much as 90% in local streams. 50 years ago, the San Lorenzo River supported 19,000 of these trout each year, and coastal tributaries were home to another 24,000. The fish were listed as federally endangered in 1997, a finding that was reaffirmed in 2006. Due to water diversions, populations continue to dwindle. Because these species are at the southernmost end of their range, they will also be impacted as water temperatures increase due to global warming, says Fierabend. Sedimentation is also named as a critical problem. As winter rains pour down in the Santa Cruz Mountains, soil loosened by development and road construction flows into rivers and streams. Over time, sediment has come down and filled in the rocky places that fish used to rear their young, says Coker. The pools in the rivers are becoming shallow, and this impacts the water temperature. Most fish need cool, deep pools in order to spawn and grow, and sedimentation changes both conditions. Along with wells that detract from the base flow into rivers and homes that use too much water from local streams, Coker blames sedimentation and deforestation for the loss of local coho salmon runs over the last 30 years. These spawners typically grow to 30 inches long and weigh as much as 13 pounds, and the fish were a cornerstone of the Santa Cruz fishing industry. Tourists come from across the nation to catch local coho during the fishing season, if there is one. Sometimes there would be lines of fishermen 3 people deep. Some fished in waders, some fished from shore, and some would be scattered in between, said John Ricker, director of the Santa Cruz County Water Resources Division. Today, there are not enough local fish of any species to support a sporting industry, and according to Caltrout, the Central Coast coho salmon is nearly extinct. The southernmost population of remaining coho are in Scott and Waddell Creeks in Santa Cruz County, with the largest remaining population in Loganudas Creek in Marin, which we just read a story about a moment ago. A few scant populations can also be found in Mendocino. Because the young rear for 1 or 2 years in cold water streams, they need protective cover provided by falling trees, and as dense coastal rainforests have been logged, the fish have dwindled away. Although populations were partially revitalized in the early 20th century, modern efforts have been unsuccessful, likely due to sedimentation and ongoing development of forested land, said Coker. The role played by magnetic fields in salmon reintroduction and migrating is just beginning to gain attention, and while redesigning hatcheries might prove useful, Lohman says, there is no single approach that will solve the problem. To address water diversion and sedimentation problems, roads must be brought up to standard, pipes must be built to carry water under roadways, and native ground cover must be planted to prevent bare dirt from eroding. Adopting low-flush toilets, planting native water-tolerant plants, and generally conserving water is also critical, said Fierabend. While this won't restore local waterways to their historic glory, the San Lorenzo used to be full enough that residents commuted to town from the boardwalk by boat, after all. It might return enough water for the fish to make their runs. Until this happens, Fierabend said, the status of California's native fish will serve as an emblem of the water problem of the Pacific Coast. The report verified that without interventions taken, 2/3 of our native species will go extinct over the next 100 years. The issue is not only about fish, it's also about the health of California's aquatic ecosystem, said Lohman. The reports continually seem to provide a thorough and careful analysis of the state of California's fish, and the outlook is alarming. Let's go with this one here. A Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals overrules Flathead National Forest decision, putting roads ahead of grizzlies. A common theme in government environmental policy is to create eco-protections that can be easily discarded in favor of industrial needs. On rare occasion, these maneuvers are found to be unlawful. That was by the editor of Forest Policy Research. The 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has reversed a court ruling that allowed the Flathead National Forest to avoid strict adherence to road management standards in the area burned in the 2001 Moose Fire. In a 5-page ruling issued recently, the appellate court found the U.S. District Judge Donald Molloy erred in applying his own standard for determining when land uses compete with the habitat needs of grizzly bears, a threatened species. The court order calls for the Forest Service to establish and apply a standard when land use values compete with grizzly bears' needs within the meaning of the forest plan. In addition to salvage logging, the Moose Post-Fire Project involved road management provisions that mostly called for forest roads to be closed or obliterated to meet road density standards adopted in 1995 under the Forest Plan Amendment 19. But the post-fire project included a site-specific amendment that allowed the Forest Service to deviate from the road density standards. Forest Road 316 was allowed to remain open, and nearly a dozen culverts were retained under other roads that were supposed to be closed by culvert removal. The culverts were retained to allow for continued snowmobiling access under the terms of a settlement agreement reached in separate litigation over that access. Environmental groups including Friends of the Wild Swan, the Swan View Coalition, Alliance for the Wild Rockies, and Wildland CPR sued in 2003, challenging the project's road management plans. Judge Molloy ruled in favor of the Forest Service in 2006. The Flathead was wrong when it chose motorized recreation over grizzly bears, said Arlene Montgomery, program director for Friends of the Wild Swan. Finally, they must follow their own forest plan standards and the law. Keith Hammer, chairman of the Swan View Coalition, added that this ruling means you can't promise wildlife one thing in your forest plan and then arbitrarily take it away when it's time to go logging and motoring. Hammer and Montgomery assert that the ruling means the Flathouse Forest must redo travel management portions of the Moose Project to bring it into compliance with the forest road density standards. But that may not be the case, said Joe Kruger, environmental coordinator for the Flathead Forest. We are definitely not clear what it means and how to proceed from here. We'll be sitting down with our attorney, said Kruger, who believes the appellate court ruling appears to be calling for more definition in the forest plan. And that's all the time we have for news this week on the Earth First Update. If you'd like to hear a podcast or rebroadcast of this week's Earth First Update or previous Earth First Updates, you can go to the following webpage, www.h2opodcast.com. That's h2opodcast.com. Click on Earth and select Earth First Radio. And we want to thank the folks at the H2O podcast site for recording and providing these broadcasts for your listening pleasure. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz and can be heard every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 and www.freakradio.org. Thanks for listening. There'll be another Earth First Update next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock. So.